understand, we had a public hearing on it, and so we're just going to do a work session.
Yeah.
You want to tell us what the bill does, and
I think I'll be happy.
Tell the committee what the bill does.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 2477 increases the maximum amount that can be credited to the Workers' Memorial Scholarship account from civil penalties recovered for violations of OSHA laws or rules. The fund is currently limited to $100,000, and House Bill 2477 would increase that to $250,000. That would increase the interest income that is used for these scholarships.
Okay, we've had a public hearing on it, and we've had a public hearing on this, and we'll probably just do a work session on it. That's okay. I'll move the bill. Okay. Yes, if you will, sir.
I would move House Bill 2477 to the floor to do past recommendations.
Okay, we need discussion. Have a voice vote, please.
Senator Wild, Senator Starr.
Aye.
Senator Shannon. Senator Duke.
Aye.
Chair Burford.
Aye. Passes. And now we'll have a...
Who do you want to have here?
Okay. Okay.
No.
Why don't we put 2450?
Did you send a period?
Yeah, it's a period. 2450?
Yeah. Okay,
we
have on ship
right now. Okay, we haven't had a public hearing on that one?
No, we haven't.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2450. And we have John Gervais and Bob Shiprack. Do you want to testify on that?
Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Bob Shiprack with the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I'm here this morning on House Bill 2450. Still had extensive discussions in the House. What the bill does is allow in the construction industry unionized groups and their employer associations, respective employer associations, to collectively bargain certain aspects of workers' compensation. As you're probably aware, under Oregon's law and most laws across the country, workers' compensation is a one-size-fits-all. Construction workers, school teachers, nurses, firefighters all are under the same laws, and sometimes that doesn't work to the best, and one size doesn't always fit all. The problem we have in construction is that we have a multi-employer industry. We go from contractor to contractor. My best year, I worked for 15 different employers, and we don't add it. I wasn't fired once.
I was going to ask you that in the question series.
It was a very good year, and I just turned out and wanted to travel around a little bit. But and we don't ask our employers who their workers' comp carrier is when we go on the job, and who in today's world, who their managed health care organization and all that is. So what we're trying to do with this bill, and I should mention, this legislation has passed in 10 other states. This is not the first time this issue has come up, and I copied this bill basically out of the California statutes, which they have down there. And it's working very well. There are a number of unions and their employer associations. I got the book here from Southern California. This is the National Electrical Contractors Association and Electrical Workers Plan in Southern California. There are a number of other groups. The bill is limited, however, to two organizations, and it lists in the bill those issues that we may discuss. I want to state that this bill is simply permissive legislation. It allows us to go out and talk to the contractors, and the contractors have been waiting for the legislation to pass, particularly the Electrical and Mechanical Contractors Association. We've had discussions with the Iron Workers Contractors as well, but it allows, it's permissive legislation, and it would allow these discussions to start. I don't know where they'll go. They may not go anywhere, but at least it gives us a chance to sit down and see if there's some things that we can do collaboratively to make the system work just a little bit better. One of the problems that kind of sparked this is we've been big proponents of early return to work programs, and because of the varying types of return to work programs, my people and my contractors, frankly, is it's getting very confusing out there as to how those are supposed to operate, and that'd be one of the things that we could sit down and deal with. In construction, as you're probably all aware, we're used to these types of arrangements under the Taft-Hartley Act. A lot of the activities we do are joint labor management cooperative things, such as our health insurance, our pension program, our apprenticeship program, are all jointly discussed and carried out. So this would be just one other thing that we would sit down and talk about. It's also voluntary. This is not tied to any of the master labor agreements. If the contractor chooses to do this, it is voluntary, whether or not they're signatory with us or not. So they're not forced into this. This is something that they would want to do. So I'll stop there and see if there's
any questions for that. Go ahead, John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much. My name is John Gervais. I represent the National Electrical Contractors Association and the Chief Level Contractors. We've looked long and hard, our organization has looked long and hard at this, and of course, worked with you since the 80s and workers' comp issues, and all have worked to make them reasonable and fair to both sides. The California experience that our organization has had has been very, very positive. It's with its mediation and arbitration, it's cut down on costs, and it's cut down on the friction between individuals, and cut down on big litigation. We, in this particular bill, we were concerned as it was being drafted that, quite frankly, that did not be required, that we not have to negotiate it, that it shouldn't be a hammer used against us, and it is not. That was one of our major concerns, and we want to make sure also that if our individual contractors felt that they wanted to continue with a certain insurance company, that that be a part of the opportunity also. And I think this is another tool, an opportunity for groups, especially like ours in the collective bargaining situation for people like Bob, who can't hold a job, worked for many people in 1 year. And my son now is an apprentice down in Medford for electrical. He's still on the same job after 3 months. Three weeks, excuse me, longer than Bob's record. But anyway, in all seriousness, this is a very important part of our industry. We want to make sure that we, number one, try to protect them from injury in the first place. But then this gives us an opportunity to get involved with the injured worker and their family immediately. Take care of their needs, work with them if there's a problem, and keep litigation out of it as much as possible. And I would encourage you to give us an opportunity to pursue this. And again, it's voluntary. It's probably I guess because of 10 states and then in California, it isn't necessarily a test case situation, but to give us an opportunity to, in one segment of the workers' comp world, to, I think, make some savings that don't cut into the benefits for the injured worker or others, but just in for a reason to take place.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you both for sitting.
Yes.
We have one more, Jennifer Weber.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Jennifer Weber. I'm representing the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys. And I'm here this morning to express you some concerns that we have about House Bill 2450. And first, I'd like to state that members of the Oregon Workers' Comp Attorneys are very supportive of collective bargaining agreements and the benefits that it brings to workers. Many of our members represent unions, and in addition to workers' compensation law, practice labor, and employment law, but these same attorneys see problems with House Bill 2450. As you heard in previous testimony, 10 states do have in place laws which allow collective bargaining of workers' comp in certain circumstances. And while each state's laws are somewhat different, they do have in common an alternative dispute resolution system, an ADR, as does House Bill 2450 allows that in the collective bargaining agreement. And this is where our concerns, they center around the ADR process. In other states, in the first two steps of the ADR process, usually involving an ombudsman and mediation, the states have disallowed the worker from being represented by an attorney in these disputes. The worker may go consult an attorney at their own expense, but in the actual process, they've been disallowed from having an attorney there. The agreements, however, have not disallowed the employer's representative or the insurer's representative from being an attorney. So we feel that this places not only the injured worker at a disadvantage, but also it could create some liability on the part of the union if the union representative, who may or may not be present at these talks, is not an attorney, who the union may be opening themselves up to some liability in terms of that. In addition to attorneys who have been trained to spot potential third-party cases, in Oregon we do allow third-party cases in the workers' compensation arena. If perhaps a worker has been injured by a piece of faulty equipment, the injured worker's attorney may spot that, pursue a third-party case, and if they win that case, the workers' comp carrier can recover some of their costs, etc. If an attorney is disallowed from the process, these types of things won't happen. And our concern is that this is a diminishment of the injured worker's rights from the current law. So we would just like to make sure that the department is aware of that, that in House Bill 2450, as it's before you today, it states that the department has will have rulemaking to look at the ADR process put in place in the collective bargaining agreement. We'd like you to be aware and the department to be aware that we believe that the injured worker should be able to be represented by an attorney should they so desire. And also I'd like to say for the record that the previous witnesses said that costs have decreased in California. I've been in contact with people in California, and the initial reports from there do not indicate any cost savings. In addition, Mr. Gervais mentioned the decrease in litigation. I would submit that the decrease in litigation may simply be not that the disputes don't exist, but because of the inability of the worker to have an attorney, they're simply not, the worker is not being appropriately advocated for. And those are our concerns. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Well, appreciate your concerns. This is a kind of a pilot program. You see how it works, and you can take a look at it next session.
Absolutely, and we'll participate in rulemaking process with our committee as well.
Thanks, Susan. Anyone else want to speak on this 2450? If not, we're going to close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2450.
Mr. Chairman, Move 2450. The floor to be passed recommendation.
Okay, any discussion? Hearing none, let's take a voice vote, please.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Senator Sarah?
Aye.
Senator Cannon?
Aye.
Senator Duke?
Aye.
Chair Durbin?
Aye. Carries. And should I carry on? Okay, we've had testimony on Senate Bill 2022 in a public hearing, so we're going to go into a work session on 2022. And Brian, you want to explain the bill?
House Bill 2022 increases workers' compensation benefits for spouse and certain children of federally injured workers. What it does specifically, as Chris Davies from State testified on March 3rd, it ensures that the benefits for children in high school or in higher ed are equal to the benefits for children under age 18. It ensures that benefits for children are not reduced if the deceased parent is remarried. It increases the remarriage allowance for fatal claims. And the final thing that the bill does is there is one elimination, and that is it eliminates a $5 per week additional payment for permanent temporary disability workers. And that is eliminated because it's $5 a week. It's eliminated because it's archaic. And
you want to leave it in? Okay. Does everyone understand what the bill does? We've had this before. Okay, Joan, do you want to move it?
Sure, Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2022 to the floor with a pass recommendation.
Okay, any discussion? Not, let's take a roll call vote, please.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Senator Sarr?
Aye.
Senator
Cannon?
Aye.
Senator
Buecher?
Aye.
Senator Buecher? Aye. You want to say that one? Okay, we will see.
How much people sign up here? I'll go get the list.
Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing in Bill 2021. Okay, we have John Slitz, Jim Anderson, and Joe Gilliam. Ed, you want to come forward, please? Hey, thanks for coming, and you can start off any way you wish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Schultz. I'm the manager of the benefits section, the Workers' Compensation Division, Department of Consumer and Business Services. The Workers' Compensation statute provides that only limited medical services shall be delivered to workers who have become medically stationary. Until January 1999, there was an administrative rule that said that medical providers could continue to provide medical services and be reimbursed for those medical services to a worker before that provider was notified that the worker was actually medically stationary. The Department of Justice advised the Department of Consumer and Business Services that we might not have statutory authority for that rule. We changed the rule to actually provide a penalty for failure to notify the medical provider, but we are still concerned that we don't have statutory authority for that rule either. This bill assures that medical providers will continue to be paid for medical services that they provide in good faith to workers with disabling claims who have been declared medically stationary and that those medical providers have not yet been notified that they're medically stationary. As a practical matter, the attending physician is the one who usually declares the worker medically stationary. However, there are exceptions sometimes. Sometimes the insurer makes that determination based on a preponderance of medical evidence, or the declaration is done via a consulting physician. Insurers at times fail to notify the attending physician, setting up the possibility that that attending physician will continue providing services to the worker that they should not provide under the law after the worker is declared mentally stationary. Now, the Management Labor Advisory Committee, the legislative subcommittee of that committee, reviewed this concept and endorsed it. It has been endorsed by the Medical Advisory Committee to the Workers' Compensation Division. The actual language for this bill was worked out between the Oregon Medical Association and Safe Corporation. The department's analysis is that neither passage nor defeat of this concept will have any fiscal impact on the department itself. And we urge you to endorse this concept and support it for the due pass
recommendation. Thanks, John.
Mr. Chairman, Jim Anderson for the OMA. You have the bill before you and the language. I could walk you through the language, the new language, very quickly. It simply states that the insurer or self-insured employer could establish today in a disabling claim when an injured worker is medically stationary. And in the amendment, you'll note that this is not based on the findings, solely on the findings of the attending physician. However, I think it could be argued that no insurer would make that claim of medical, being medically stationary without first consulting with the physician, the attending physician. It's very simple and straightforward, and we would like to thank the department for bringing this to the attention of the ONA and eventually to the legislative body. And also like to thank the cooperation of this baby state for helping us get the language that's before you. And quite honestly, most of that revolves around the issue of written notification to the attending physician that the injured worker was deemed to be medically stationary. That was something that we wanted to have and wasn't originally included in the language of the bill. There are two amendments that I have with this. I'm not sure what staff may have additionally. There could have been potentially many more amendments to this bill, but there are the dash fours that I still have, the A4s and the dash A8, which Mr. Gilliam will speak to. But the A4s, if staff agrees, I think the A4s take out what would essentially be the last half of this bill from section four, or on page four. Well, I have a page four, lines 28 through 45, and the loose pages 5 and 6. With that, we have done.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Joe Gilliam with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're here today in support of this bill and the -8A8 amendment. Mr. Anderson just mentioned that the -4 took up on page 4, lines 28 through 45, and also 5 and 6. The A8 also does that. In addition, the A8 amendments are amendments that we're supporting on the bill that would require all workers' compensation insurers, whether public or private, that when they quote prices or advertise prices, that they only quote premiums or net premiums based on conditions and figures that they can guarantee for that policy. They cannot net give you a net price of your premium based on projections or dividends on interest income and things like that, where it becomes kind of a pricing gimmick. It does not prohibit, however, the discussion of dividends, the historical value of dividends that company may have produced, but they can't use it as a pricing. So when a small business owner gets a price on insurance, they're getting an apples-to-apples comparison on conditions and a price that they can be guaranteed.
So just to make sure we have the record straight on this amendment you're suggesting, A8, that as long as it's a guaranteed figure that those can be quoted, in other words, on a vessel plan, you can show that as a because that is a guaranteed rate. So that is not objected to. It's only that a potential change would not be used in the quote.
And Mr. Chairman of the committee, that's exactly right. A retro plan is a contractual agreement between an insurer and an employer that if you're safe, here's your discount. If you have injuries and the costs go up, then you have to pay this. It's all guaranteed as to what those conditions are. So they could talk about retro. Anything that's guaranteed or contracted under the contract or in the policy.
Okay, but there would be nothing wrong with the a person that looking to buy the policy would have an indication from the insurance company that there could be a potential rebate from the earnings of that policy.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. They could talk about potential earnings from dividends or any other such mechanism, but they just couldn't quote it as part of the price.
But it could be in writing. You keep saying quote, it could be in writing also that there is a potential dividend available.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. It just should not be shown as a net quote on the premium. If you could tell them, here's the guaranteed cost of insurance, and here's some potential things based on our history we've done before that you also might be able to partake in. But you couldn't mix the two to say, here's what your insurance cost would be on potential or unguaranteed type of
So nothing is forbidden from writing it down or talking about it or in the sales talk or in the information that's given to the potential purchase for the insurance.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
The dash four amendments were alluded to. I don't see those.
They're also in the dash.
They're included in the dash eight.
They are. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2021, and we're going to open a work session on it. And I think I would like to say that we tried to work out an additional program on this particular bill. That's why we haven't brought it forward. Unfortunately, the MLAC group wasn't able to reach consensus. I personally think that we do have some people that are not being serviced properly in the system, and it needs to be corrected. And hopefully, sometime they're going to get together and do that. And if they don't do it, I think that we're going to have lots of problems in the future in this program. So I just would suggest that the people ought to get together and make sure that people are not falling through the cracks, which I believe they are right now. And if we don't do that, I think we'll pay a big price for it. With that, we'll entertain the motion.
Mr. Chair, I have a question about
complete
dash 8, which I guess was actually dash first part. Where I have a question, I guess, is the 4. It appears to me that Section 2 is identical to Section 1, except that it may be conflict amendments. That's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah.
And now we're going to delete them?
Senator Dukes, the conflict amendments are included in the dash A8, even though it's not labeled as conflict amendments. I checked with the drafter yesterday.
Because of the Section 3, is that it?
Because...
this is what deals with the conflict.
Section 3 also deals with the conflict, and so I wondered if that was what made Section 2 not necessary.
Right, that Section 2 is duplicative language.
Well, it is, except the, and I assume that was the conflict part of the amendment, the thing, which is sort of repeated back here, not exactly, but sort of. I guess if LC says this is the way to do it, this is the way we do it.
Okay.
And sure, I'll move the dash A8 for House Bill 2021.
The Senator Dukes has moved the dash A8 amendments. Any objection? Hearing none. Take the amendments.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2021 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, any discussion? If not, can we have a voice vote, please?
For the
while.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Carry. Tom, do you want to carry that one?
Sure.
You okay?
I guess you can't hide around.
Okay, now we're down to Senate Bill This is 1330. We had a skip for that.
Mr. Chair,
we're going to open a closed session on 1330.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering Senate Bill 1330A.
Senator Starr moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering Senate Bill 1330A. Any discussion?
No discussion.
Do we have a roll call vote, please?
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator
Shannon?
Aye.
Senator
Biggs?
Aye.
Senator Gerber?
Aye. Motion carries. The rules have been suspended.
Mr. Chair, I move that committee reconsider Senate Bill 1338.
Senator Starr moves committee reconsider Senate Bill 1338 as a discussion. Hearing none, we'll have a roll call vote, please.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator
Biggs? Aye.
Senator Gerber?
Aye. Okay. Back in the hands of the committee, and we're going to wait just a little bit until we get some amendments apart. We'll open up a work session on House Bill 3605. Again, you want to cover what this bill does so that everybody knows what we're voting on?
House Bill 3605 provides that the $500,000 limitation on recovery of non-economic damages applies to wrongful death claims under the Employer Liability Act. It eliminates pure comparative negligence and claims under the Employer Liability Act and substitutes comparative negligence standard that's applicable in other tort actions. And we heard testimony on this on the 15th.
Okay, no amendment. There's no amendment.
No. Is there any discussion on 3605? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3605 before it through pass recommendation.
Any discussion? Hearing none, we have a roll call vote, please.
Senator Wild.
Aye.
Senator Farr.
Aye.
Senator Shannon.
Aye.
Senator Dixon.
No.
Senator
Farr. Aye. Carried, and I'll go ahead and carry that one. And I think that's all we have. Okay, the committee is adjourned.
Oh, we're done?
Yeah.
Oh, we aren't going to wait for... Oh, you mean waiting for the amendments, not... It's not even.
They were coming today.
All right, Chris.